Okay, we start first with the homage to the Buddha. Start with homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. And today is June 23rd, 2012. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, we've been studying now the Markandeya Sutta. This is Sutta number 75 in the Middle Length Discourses. If you don't have a book, maybe you can sit in that seat and you can look at this copy. Excuse me? Okay, so this is the Markandeya Sutta. And just to sort of recapitulate what we covered last week, the Buddha is staying in a potter shed where he encounters a wanderer named Markandeya, who has heard, in his tradition, he's heard bad reports about the Buddha, that they call the Buddha a destroyer of growth, or maybe even that word means an abortionist. And the Buddha understands the reason why he's gained that reputation, because Markandeya is kind of a hedonist or a sensualist, even though he's a wandering ascetic. But he believes that we should give freely indulge the senses in their objects of enjoyment. Whereas he has heard that the Buddha teaches restraint of the senses, self-mastery of the mind, and so on. And so this has kind of makes a negative impression on Markandeya. Then the Buddha gives a kind of exposition which shows, we could call this the relative strength or the relative value of different types of pleasure or happiness. And so we have, when we take the pleasures of the senses, then we compare them to the pleasures of the heavenly worlds, then the pleasures of the senses are inferior. But the Buddha argues or maintains that he knows even a superior pleasure, a kind of pleasure or happiness, a delight that exists apart from sensual pleasures, and which is superior even to divine or celestial bliss. And then the Buddha illustrates the pleasure that comes from indulging the senses with a very powerful simile of a man, maybe a leper, who has a skin disease, these scabs and sores on his arms and legs, and they're constantly itching him, and so he scratches the itching, the wounds, and when he does this, it gives him a kind of pleasure. And then sometimes he would heat up a charcoal fire, and then he would roast his arms and legs, the wounds, over the charcoal fire, and that will give him again a kind of pleasure. And so this represents the pleasures of the senses. They come from a kind of compulsive need, which is the need of craving. When we indulge them, then we get a kind of pleasure. But then, after we indulge that scratching of the senses through indulgence, after some time, the scratching returns again, the sensual desire returns again. And then the Buddha takes this example of the leper to the point where he gets cured of his illness. And when he's cured of his illness, even if people try to drag him towards that charcoal pit so he could warm up his arms and legs and get a pleasure out of them, he would recoil from the charcoal pit, because he knows that the charcoal pit all along has been hot and burning and harmful. And so in the same way, the Buddha says that all along the sensual pleasures have been hot and scorching. In the future, they will be hot and scorching. But it's because our faculties have been impaired or damaged. That is, our faculty of wisdom has been damaged by ignorance. And so we're not able to see them as they really are. And thus we get a mistaken perception of the sense pleasures as pleasant. And so now I'm on page 612. Towards the bottom of the page, the Buddha then says, so for living beings who are not free from lust for sensual pleasures, who are devoured by craving for sensual pleasures, who burn with the fever for sensual pleasures, they still indulge in sensual pleasures. And the more they do so, then the more their craving for sensual pleasures increases, and the more they are burned by their fever for sensual pleasures, and yet they still find a certain measure of satisfaction and enjoyment in dependence upon the five objects of sensual pleasure. Okay, so this is as far as we got last week. Okay, now the Buddha is continuing in his debate with Magandhya, and he asks Magandhya, have you ever seen or heard of a king or a royal minister enjoying himself with the five objects of sensual pleasures, who, without abandoning craving for sensual pleasures, without removing the fever for sensual pleasures, was able to abide free from thirst, this thirst here is craving, with a mind inwardly at peace, or who is able or will be able to so abide in the future. So, especially in the Buddha's time, kings had power over whatever, everything in their realm, and so they could enjoy all of the pleasures, the worldly pleasures that they wanted. Some of the kings, well, this was in Central Asia, like I think it was Genghis Khan or Kublai Khan. He would ask his lieutenants to go out through the kingdom and to search for all girls between the ages of 15 and 18 to find those that met up to, that fulfilled certain standards of beauty, and then bring them to the palace. And then each one would bring a few of these maidens to the palace, and then the king would choose which ones he wanted for his to become his wives and dismiss the others or keep the others as concubines. And then the kings would be able to, enjoy the most delicious types of foods. They have the best cooks preparing the most sumptuous dishes every day. They have dancers and musicians. So all the pleasures and delights of the senses. And yet, even though they can indulge their desire for every type of sense pleasure, their minds are never really calm and tranquil. They're never inwardly at peace. Okay, so Magandhya admits this. So then the Buddha says, I too have known that this is the case. Because the Buddha actually lived under such conditions, the conditions of royalty. But now the Buddha continues. He says, on the contrary, it is those recluses or Brahmins, who abide free from thirst with a mind inwardly at peace, all do so after they have understood as they really are the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape in the case of sensual pleasures. And it is after abandoning craving for sensual pleasures and removing the fever or lust for sensual pleasures that they abide free from thirst with a mind inwardly at peace. Okay, so this lays down, you could say, the condition for achieving this perfect, imperturbable peace of mind. First, one has to understand sense pleasures as they really are. And that means to understand them in terms of these 5 points, how they originate, how sense pleasures arise, how they pass away, how they disappear. That means seeing the impermanence of sense pleasures, that sense pleasures come into being and pass away, so they're impermanent. Seeing the gratification in sense pleasures, because of contact with the objects, there arises a kind of pleasure, pleasant feeling, a kind of joy born of sensual pleasures, and that gives some degree of enjoyment. That is the gratification. Then there's the danger, the drawback, or the disadvantage in sensual pleasures. What would be some of the disadvantages or dangers in sensual pleasures, for example?
Addiction.
Okay, one drawback is addiction. One becomes addicted to them. So if you don't get the pleasure one wants, then what happens? Yeah, one starts to get irritated and annoyed and frustrated. And some other dangers in sensual. What are some other dangers or drawbacks in sensual pleasures?
Envy.
Okay, that's a good one. Yeah, there comes envy, especially if one starts comparing oneself with others. You know, this king who might have a kingdom of such and such a size looks across the border and sees that the king in the other state has a bigger territory than himself. And so he has to start waging war against the other kingdom in order to be able to annex some of his territory into his own state so he could have a bigger kingdom. Or even that's on national level, but day-to-day level, you know, one sees your neighbor has a nicer car than you do. Okay, so envy arises. Some other disadvantages?
Anger.
How?
Anger, you know, vision, yeah. And grief. Or else, you know.
Okay, but some example of how anger will arise from sense pleasure. Yeah, actually, this is the... I should have mentioned the rule. Yeah, first you take the... You'd have to take the microphone. Yeah. Yeah, because it has to get into the recording.
I'm sorry.
Whether you want it or not, but...
But I mean, see, when I say anger arises, I mean, it's just part of everything. I mean, isn't that the reason why we suffer? You know, anger, greed, and delusion.
Yeah.
Is that
what
the king is going
to do, right? Yeah, but let's just get a specific example.
Okay.
So I was given a bottle of Nutella recently, and
a bottle of
Nutella. It's a chocolate hazelnut spread like peanut butter, but it's very sweet.
Oh yeah.
So if I come into the kitchen and see one of my housemates eating from that jar, my sense pleasure immediately generates, as you were saying, anger that there's a loss of my supply and it's not in my stomach.
Okay, that's a good example. Anything else? Okay. Asman?
Greed and lust.
Okay. But let's say something like a little more specific. You want to say about greed or lust?
Wanting more things that you enjoy.
Excuse me?
Wanting more things that you enjoy.
Okay. That's a good way to put it. That the more you enjoy, then the more you want the next time. So you could say that craving keeps on increasing and increasing. Okay, usually the way it's stated in the Buddhist texts, that always the danger is stated the same way, that it's impermanent, bound up in some way with dukkha, with suffering or dissatisfaction, and subject to change, to pass away. Okay, so that's the danger, and then there's the escape or release in the case of sensual pleasures. And in a way, the Buddha has already indicated what the release is here. It's the abandoning the craving for sensual pleasures and removing that fever or the thirst for sensual pleasures. Okay, so the Buddha has, in a sense, you could say, he scored this point in the debate with Magandhya. Now, according to the Pali version of this sutta, the Buddha recites a verse. I think this verse comes in the Dhammapada. The greatest of all gains is health. Nibbana is the greatest bliss. The Eightfold Path is the best of paths, for it leads safely to the deathless. Okay, now, when the Buddha says this, then the wanderer Magandhya is very pleased with the Buddha's statement. So he says, "It's wonderful, Master Gotama. It's marvelous how well you have expressed this." And then he recites just the first two lines. The greatest of all gains is health. Nibbana is the greatest bliss. And he says, we too have heard this from the older wanderers in our sect. And they agree, what they say agrees completely with what you, the Buddha, what you say. Okay, now this is an interesting point that I learned from my friend Venerable Analio in his book comparing the Pali version of the Majjhima Nikaya with other versions that have come down in other schools. In the Chinese counterpart to the Majjhima Nikaya, the verse that the Buddha recites at this point has only the first two lines. The greatest of all gains is health. Nibbana is the greatest bliss. And it seems to me that this is more convincing than having all four lines. Because if the Buddha recites all four lines, then in a way he's giving his game away. Or he's like a card player who's showing his, what do you call it, the trump card? You know, the card that's going to beat the other guys? I don't know, I don't remember card games. Is that called the trump card? Okay, somebody knows card playing. Or it's like a fisherman, in a sense, showing the hook around that runs through the bait. But the Buddha just wants to throw out some bait or to bluff the opponent by throwing out, if he just throws out two lines, then Magandhya will, in a sense, bite the bait and fall into the Buddha's trap. Because if the Buddha recites all four lines, then he's speaking about the Noble Eightfold Path and speaking about the deathless. And so Magandhya would get maybe even deterred and discouraged and walk off. Of course, Magandhya maybe is still convinced about his point of view. But if the Buddha just recites the first two lines, okay, the greatest of all gains is health, Nibbana is the greatest bliss, Magandhya hears something that he could agree with. And so then the Buddha says to him, we're on page 614 now, he says, when you heard from the older wanderers about the saying from the older wanderers, what were they referring to as health? What was it that they were calling Nibbana or Nirvana? Okay, you could say that in India in the Buddha's time, the word Nibbana or Nirvana was known. It wasn't exclusively a Buddhist word. And so it generally had the sense of a state of perfect well-being, a state of perfect happiness. And there was even a school of thought in the Buddha's time which held, they call it the Paramadita Dhamma Nibbana, supreme Nibbana here and now, supreme Nibbana in this very life. And this position held basically that when a person can freely enjoy all the senses to the utmost of his ability, that is Nirvana in this very life. So it seems Magandhya could have belonged or followed that system of thought. So when the Buddha asked him, what do you understand by Nirvana? Magandhya rubs his limbs, his chest with his own hands, and then he says, this is what I understand by health. This is what I understand by Nirvana. Namely, that I am now healthy and happy and nothing afflicts me. I'm free from any kind of illness, no kinds of bodily ailments, no rheumatism, no toothache, headache, stomach ache. So he must have been maybe one of these really strong, healthy, massive types of ascetics. Okay, so you could see what he understands by Nirvana is something quite different from what the Buddha understands. It's not the deathless, but it's being happy and healthy right here and now. Okay, now the Buddha is going to bring in another one of these very powerful similes, an extended simile. Okay, he says, suppose there was a man who was born blind, so he could not see dark and light forms, could not distinguish blue, yellow, red, or pink, who could not see what was even or uneven, who cannot see the stars, the sun, the moon. Then a man with good eyesight comes along and says, it's good to wear, to have a white cloth, good to be wearing a white cloth, beautiful, spotless, and clean. And so the blind man would then go in search of a white cloth. He would try to go everywhere at inquiring, how can I get a white cloth? Okay, then a man comes along, kind of crooked, cheating man, with a dirty, soiled garment, and says to him, my friend, I'm just laughing because if you've been in India, you know exactly this type of person. You want to change money on the black market? I give you a good bargain. So a man comes along and says, here is a white cloth for you. Beautiful. It's spotless. It's clean, really clean. And he accepts it. He puts it on. He's satisfied with it. And then he utters words of satisfaction. He goes around to his friends, his family members. He says, good is this white cloth. Beautiful. Spotless and clean. Okay, so now the Buddha says, what do you think, Magandhya, when that blind man accepted, probably for a price, you know, the cheating man didn't give it away to him for free. So when that blind man, we say, bought that dirty, soiled garment, put it on, and then being satisfied with it, went around praising it, saying this white cloth is beautiful, spotless, and clean. Did he do so knowing and seeing, or out of faith in the man with the good eyesight, the man who sold it to him? Of course, Magandhya says that he did so not through knowledge, not through his own eyesight, but he did so because he believed the man who, with good sight, who sold it to him. Okay, so now the Buddha says, and this is pretty strong, so too, Magandhya, those wanderers of other sects are blind and without vision. They do not know health. They do not see Nibbana. Yet they utter the stanza, thus, the greatest of all gains is health. Nibbana is the greatest bliss. Then he says, this stanza was uttered by the Buddhas of the past. They said, the greatest of all gains is health. Nibbana is the greatest bliss. Then he completes it. At this point, the Buddha would complete it. The Eightfold Path is the best of paths, for it leads to safety, to the deathless. Okay, so this is what the Buddhas would have said, the past Buddhas, like Kassapa Buddha or Konagamana Buddha. And then that saying, probably the way the Buddha is expressing it, got passed down from generation to generation. And probably, if my hypothesis is correct, the second two lines would have gotten lost, so all that was preserved were the first two lines. And then it passed to ordinary people who would just go around saying that the greatest of all gains is health, nirvana is the greatest bliss, without knowing anything about the Eightfold Path or the deathless. And so in this way, it came down to the wanderers like Magandhya. And so now the Buddha says that this body, Magandhya, again, this is a very powerful statement on the body, is a disease, a tumor, a dart, a calamity, an affliction. But referring to this body, you say that this is health, this is nirvana. You do not have that noble vision by means of which you might know what is really meant by health, by which you might see Nibbana. So at this point now, it seems with that statement, the Buddha has broken through the kind of mental obstruction that Magandhya was putting up. He broke down the resistance of Magandhya, first by showing him the real nature of sensual pleasures. Probably he got halfway with that argument. And now by knocking down Magandhya's attachment to the body as being the real meaning of nirvana, he's knocked down Magandhya's attachment to the body. And so he's told him just straight out, you don't even have, you're like a blind man. You don't even have the eyes by which you can see what is really meant by good health, what is really meant by nirvana. And since, the way I understand it, Magandhya's defenses have been taken down, now he's opened up and starts to place trust in the Buddha. He's no longer the Buddha's adversary, ready to argue with him, to dismiss him, to denigrate him. But he admits now that he's gaining confidence or trust in the Buddha. So he says, "I have confidence in Master Gotama thus, that you are capable of teaching me the Dharma in such a way that I can know what is really meant by good health, and that I can see Nirvana." Okay, now the Buddha doesn't start off straight away by teaching Magandhya directly, but he continues with the simile about the man blind from birth. Okay, we have this man who's born blind, who cannot see forms and so on. Then his friends and relatives bring a doctor to treat him. The doctor makes medicine, and by means of that medicine, the man's vision would not arise or be purified. So wouldn't that doctor reap weariness and disappointment? So Magandhya says, yes. So the Buddha says, if I were to teach you the Dharma about the meaning of real health, the meaning of Nirvana, you might not know what I'm talking about. You might not understand me. And so that would be wearisome for me. That would be troublesome for me. Why do you think the Buddha isn't going straight into a direct teaching to Magandhya? It seems like the Buddha is being a bit cruel here, no? A bit stubborn. I mean, he's supposed to be so compassionate. So why doesn't he just think, wow, Magandhya says he has confidence in me. Let me start teaching him the Dhamma.
Especially if he's running death.
Okay, that's a good way to put it. Okay, take the microphone and say it again. I don't think it's on.
Hello?
Yeah, okay, now it's on.
Yeah, well, he's looking to see if he's really ready to join the sangha.
Okay, that's a good way to put it. Anybody put it in a different way? Okay, Sandy?
The Buddha's strategy to make the Gandhiya to learn the Dharma more eagerly.
Okay, what was the first word the Buddha is?
I think it may be the Buddha's strategy. Strategy,
okay. Yeah, exactly.
To make the Gandhiya to want to learn the Buddha more eagerly.
Yeah, that's exactly the way I would understand it. He sort of, maybe you could say, whetting his appetite. Or sort of stimulating the desire in him, because if the Buddha starts teaching right away, then Magandhya is not yet really eager to learn, and then the Buddha might teach and Magandhya might not understand. But if the Buddha sort of holds back a little bit until Magandhya says, "I really want to learn, please, please, please teach," then the Buddha can teach. And then because Magandhya now has this eagerness, then he'll be able to understand. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to go in more directly, but again through the simile. So he says, okay, again there's the man born blind who cannot see forms. And then he might hear a man with good eyesight saying, "It's good to have to wear a white cloth, beautiful, spotless, and clean." He goes in search of the cloth. Then the man comes along and cheats him with a dirty, soiled garment, saying that this is the beautiful, clean, white cloth. And so he accepts it, puts it on, goes around claiming, this is my beautiful white cloth, see how nice it is, how beautiful it is. And he thinks he's impressing all of his friends. Then his friends and relatives bring a physician to treat him. The physician makes medicine, and by means of that medicine, the man's vision would arise and be purified. And now, together with the arising of his vision, what would the man see? Yeah. Okay, the man would say, of course, we're assuming that the man has the conceptual categories for processing this information. You know, it might take him a while to understand the difference between a clean cloth and a dirty cloth. But just assuming, sort of for the sake of the argument, that he could process that information. You know, he thinks, I'm wearing a clean white cloth all along. Then he gains his vision, he looks, and he sees, wow, this is not a clean white cloth, but this is a dirty, greasy, soiled cloth. And I've been making a fool out of myself, going around to my friends, boasting how I have this beautiful, clean white cloth. And then his desire and liking for that dirty, soiled garment would be abandoned. And he would burn with indignation and enmity towards that man. And he might think that that, oh, this is a pretty strong thing, he would think that that man should be killed. Well, that's a little too strong for my taste. But he would think, indeed, I have long been tricked, cheated, and defrauded by that man with this dirty, soiled garment who is going around telling me, this is a white cloth, wear it, it's beautiful, it's spotless and clean. Okay, that is all part of the simile, the analogy. Now the Buddha is going to draw out the implications. And this is going to be, I have to say, it's really one of the most direct, hardest-hitting expositions of the Dhamma that I know in the whole Majjhima Nikaya. Okay, so now the Buddha says, if, Maggandhya, I were to teach you the Dhamma thus, this is that health, this is nirvana, nibbana, you might know the real meaning of health. You might see Nibbana. Together with the arising of your vision, your desire and lust, or your desire and attachment for the five aggregates subject to clinging might be abandoned, then perhaps you might think, indeed, I have long been tricked, cheated, and defrauded by this mind. For when I was clinging, what I was clinging to was just material form. When I was clinging, what I was clinging to was just feeling. I was just clinging to perception. I was just clinging to the mental formations or volitional activities. I was clinging just to consciousness. Okay, when there's clinging, what is the basic idea or basic ideas in terms of which clinging occurs? What are the ideas at the base of clinging?
Perception that it's a pleasurable contact or gratification.
Okay, there is that type of clinging, but I'm thinking along a different track.
Is it a lack of understanding for the idea of permanence, the idea that this pleasure could last forever, and so if you cling on to it, then it won't ever stop?
I mean, that's true also, but there's something much simpler than that.
Self? You have to cling to the self?
Self?
Yes.
Yeah. Clinging to self, clinging to the notions, I, mine, myself. And what is the, you call it, the objective sphere of the clinging is basically the five aggregates. So this, we could say we have the five aggregates. So the five aggregates exist. Okay, so the five aggregates are there, they're present, they are the basic, you can say, constituents or factors of experience, and then the clinging arises as something, you could say, that's parasitic on the five aggregates, just like a parasite gets lodged in the body. So clinging arises, it arises, as this young man put it, through not understanding. The clinging arises through not understanding, or using the usual Buddhist word, from ignorance. So ignorance means not knowing, not seeing the real nature of things, which means not knowing, not seeing the real nature of the five aggregates. So because we don't know, don't see the real nature of the five aggregates, then we cling to them, and to cling to them means that we view them through the lens of these things are mine, these things are the I, these things are myself. And then once the idea of I and mine comes up, then there comes the counterpart to that. You and yours, he and his, she and hers. So everything gets divided into these little packets, contending and conflicting packets. All this conflict rooted in the I and notions, I and mine, which in turn stem from ignorance. And that's the condition of, you know, all ordinary people, worldlings, always thinking in terms of I, me, mine, you, yours, myself, yourself. But now, with the arising of the I, this would be the I of vision, which sees into the ultimate truth of the Dhamma. Even just temporarily, with the first flashes, ignorance gets just blocked out temporarily. With the blocking out or falling away of ignorance, the clinging stops, and the notions, I, mine, and myself, fall away temporarily. And one then sees that what one was clinging to all along as being I, mine, myself, was just only form, only feeling, only perception, only the volitional activities, only consciousness. If I remember the Pali, it uses use two glasses. You see, it was translated just to material form. In Pali, it's pretty potent way of expressing this. Yes, that yeva gives the sense of only, simply, just. So in other words, it's form, feeling, perception, volitional activities, consciousness, which are not what all along we've been taking them to be. All along we take them to be I, mine, and myself. And now the vision of the Dhamma arises. What is called Dhammacakku, the eye of Dhamma, which is actually seeing Nibbana for the first time. And when one sees Nibbana for the first time, at the same time, one could sort of look back at the five aggregates and see them without any clinging to I, mine, and myself. Okay, so one sees just the five aggregates there. It's like a sort of carrying water in a bucket, and then it's like, or a pail, and then the bottom of the pail falls away, and all of the water spills out. It's that notion of I that has been keeping everything going falls out. And then all of the defiled emotions based upon the I fall away with it. Okay, now the Buddha, from I've been clinging just to formations, I've been clinging just to consciousness, now he's going to take this a little further. This is a little bit obscure here, but he says, and I assume that the Buddha would have spoken this more elaborately, but maybe when compiling the discourse, what he said was a bridge just to make it easy to retain. With my clinging as condition, first I'll read it, then I'll explain. With my clinging as condition, being, or I would say existence, has come to be. With existence as condition, there is birth. With birth as condition, there is old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. Okay, what do we have here? Does anybody recognize these statements? What is it? Yeah, this is like the end links in the formula for dependent origination. So this clinging becomes a condition for what's here called being or existence. Basically, what this means is that it's through this clinging, that we're always clinging to these five aggregates, taking them to be I and mine, and through that clinging, okay, when these five aggregates that make up my present personal existence, when these fall away, the clinging is still there. And so that clinging has to find some place to lodge. And so that clinging will bring about the coming into being of a new existence. So it's that clinging that drives the cycle of rebirths. So this clinging propels one. We say the clinging propels the stream of consciousness when it leaves this body at death. It propels it on to a new existence. And so you could say that potential within the clinging to create a new existence, a new life, a new birth, that is what is meant here by being or existence. And when there is that potential, that unrealized potential, then that clinging will actually instigate or start off the coming into being of a new existence. And that initial moment of coming into being of the new life is what is called birth. And then with the occurrence of birth, then is followed by growth, development, and eventually by aging, decay, and death. And within the course of that life, there will be sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. So the Buddha says, such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. Okay, so the Buddha has given a really concise but very, very potent exposition of the Dhamma to Magandhya. And then Magandhya says, I have confidence in Master Gotama, in the Buddha, that you can teach me the Dhamma in such a way that I might rise up from this very seat, cured of my blindness. So he believes that the Buddha continues to teach him, he will, even while sitting there, he will gain the vision of the Dhamma. He'll see the truth of the Dhamma for himself. Okay, so now the Buddha gives him some more practical advice. The Buddha says, Magandhya, therefore you should associate with, here, I'm not so happy with this, with true men. Now I would render this with the good persons. To remember, this was actually done by Venerable Nyanamoli back in the 1950s. When this way of speaking, gender, what this gender inclusive formulas, expressions we use now, we would say true persons, or better, good persons. By this means, really the noble ones. Associate with the good persons, the wise persons. When you associate with them, then you will hear the true Dhamma. And when you hear the true Dhamma, you will practice in accordance with the true Dhamma. And when you practice in accordance with the true Dhamma, then you will know and see for yourselves. Okay, the Buddha has mentioned three practical steps here. Okay, first there is, and this is quite significant in the Buddha's teaching, there is associating with the proper people, with the good people. This is also often called associating with, we have the expression, kalyanamita, which sometimes means, translated, good friends. So the people that we associate with influence us. And especially to learn the proper Dhamma, one has to associate with those who have at least some textual knowledge of the Dhamma, but even better, those who have the experiential realization and so can teach based on their own practice and direct understanding. Okay, when you associate with the good persons, then you will hear the true Dhamma, the proper Dhamma. You know, because there's many teachings going around which they call Dharma or Dhamma or true religion, if you believe this, then you get liberated. You believe that, you'll be saved. But you want to hear the proper Dhamma, the Dhamma that can really teach one how to distinguish what is good, what is bad, what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, what is beneficial to oneself and others, what is harmful to oneself and others, and then how to practice. Then often there is another step which comes between hearing the proper Dhamma and practicing properly. Anybody know what the other step is that's missing here?
Give ear.
No. That's giving ear is sort of already implied by hearing the truth, the good Dhamma.
Maybe ethical discipline is also implied by cutting one.
Speak more.
Ethical discipline?
I think that would be probably comprised under proper practice. There's something else. We get these four factors together. No. Either you know it or you don't.
Contemplation?
You're getting very close. But there's a special expression that we have. Bo Wei, do you know? What is the fourth one missing?
Careful or wise attention.
Okay, yeah. She said careful or wise attention. It's called yoniso manasikara, which means... Yeah, yoniso means careful or thorough or wise, and manasikara is translated attention or reflection or contemplation. So those four together make up what is called sometimes the four factors for attaining stream entry. But the Buddha teaches them that these four factors are essential at each step of the way, whether stream entry, once returning, non-returning, arhatship. It's always beneficial to associate with the good persons. When you associate with the good persons, then you hear the good Dharma. When you hear the good Dharma, then you take the Dharma as a theme for examination, reflection, consideration. You review it, reflect on it, see how it applies to one's personal life. Then one practices in accordance with the Dhamma. That is, becomes the fourth step, which sort of will already include ethical discipline, but especially practicing in accordance with the Dhamma. The way it's explained in other suttas, it's usually explained as the practice of insight meditation. Okay, then when you practice in accordance with the Dhamma, then you will know and see for yourself thus. These are diseases, tumors, and darts. What are the diseases, tumors, and darts? Right, it's the five aggregates subject to clinging. But here, these diseases, tumors, and darts sees without remainder. So this is referring to where these things sees without remainder. What is it? I thought somebody was going to say... Starbucks! Ben and Jerry's ice cream parlor. No, it's Nibbana. Okay, so that you see that the five aggregates that we're clinging to as self are really subject, always subject to suffering, and then you see Nibbana as being that state, realm, reality, which is completely free from those objects of clinging. So now when you see into that truth of Nibbana, then that clinging starts to fall away. And with the cessation of my clinging comes cessation of being or becoming. As clinging drops off, then that driving force that will create new existence, life after life, starts to become debilitated till it finally ceases. And with the cessation of being, existence, or becoming, there is the cessation of birth. With the cessation of birth, the cessation of old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. The cessation of this whole mass of suffering. Okay, so that is the Buddha's sort of concluding part of the exposition. So you can say that the Buddha has brought the discourse to its completion, to its climax, by showing the full attainment of Nibbana. And according to, I think this was said in the Chinese version, that at this point Magandhya attained stream entry. So he gained that vision of the Dhamma for himself. But that isn't in the Pali version. Maybe I'll ask at this point whether there are any questions before we just take the sutta to its end.
Yes, I have three questions, and you may differ on all of them, which I certainly respect. Going backwards, as you described it, ignorance that's related to the clinging of the aggregates, it seems to me an intensely powerful and frightening message politically in terms of the entire structure of property ownership in this country. Immensely. That's one.
What was the last word you said?
Just an immensely. Big statements of suffering here.
Yeah.
The second connection I made of the possibility, and I know this is not what was meant, of interpreting the simile of the blind man as ignorance is bliss because he was so happy not knowing.
Yeah.
And that's not what's meant, but I could go there. And then backing up to the very first one, I had heard about concerns when people are moving in this on this path of losing the that pleasure and being afraid that life is just going to be so flat without any of that.
Yeah.
Connect, attachment to any of the aggregates. So,
yeah.
And they're all the above.
Okay, these are all three very good questions. Okay, the first one, that the way ignorance is conditioned for clinging and how that reflects on the sense of property values in this country.
Property ownership.
Yeah, I mean, that's, the implications are just so vast because we place so much sense of self gets built up on how much property one owns and value of the property one owns. You know, of course, from a mundane perspective, it's good to own enough, you know, land, maybe to have one's own house, to have a house. Just the kind of ownership that's necessary to get along in day-to-day life, but that compulsive drive to acquire more and more just to bolster one's resources beyond reasonable need and just to strengthen that sense of domination and power over others and one's sense of self-importance, all of that is extremely, you know, harmful to oneself and to others. And so if people were to operate with the idea that ultimately nothing really belongs to us and we use everything that we claim as our property just as a kind of temporary expedience for getting along in life, then we could get along much more peacefully with one another. both at the personal level and at the national and international level. Okay, that's in terms of the first question. The second question, wouldn't it have been better for the blind man never to have gotten his vision, just to remain in ignorance? Well, I think all of us would think if we were blind, we would still want to gain sight. If we were blind from birth and then suddenly some doctors had come up with a remedy and we could regain our sight, we would want to regain our sight, even though it would mean that we have to look at many unpleasant things. So still consider desirable to have. In any case, don't try to push similes too far. Sometimes they don't work if you push them too hard.
That thing about ignorance being bliss, to me, the most important point in here is when the Gandhiya says that I have confidence that you can relieve me of my blindness.
Yeah.
It indicates that he has now seen that he is blind.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a tremendous move.
That's right. Yeah. That's a very, very good point. Yeah.
That has happened out of the, as you pointed out, the very gradual, presenting a metaphor. He doesn't say Buddha doesn't say you issue that.
Yeah.
And he sees you blind.
Yeah.
And then all the rest can happen.
Yeah, because when Magandhya first met the Buddha, Magandhya was so proud and he was dismissing the Buddha, almost pejoratively, like he's just that ascetic Gautama, the destroyer of growth. And now, and he's ready to argue with the Buddha. Now he's looking at the Buddha as a teacher. Now that I've answered the first two, let me see how good my memory is. Third question. Don't tell me. Okay, I give up. What was the third question?
Concerns that people in the past may have about letting go.
Oh, right, okay. That their life is just going to be dull and dreary and no pleasure at all.
Yeah.
Actually, it becomes the opposite of that. It becomes a way of moving from one level of happiness and joy to higher and deeper levels of happiness and joy. And we have to remember also that the Buddha doesn't try to teach what we call the path of renunciation to everybody all at once, but it's a gradual training. But as one develops the ability to give things up and to devote oneself to a more contemplative life, then one starts to experience the inner happiness that comes from the cultivation of the mind. So we see, for example, I think it's Sutta number 66. Well, the Buddha speaks of paviveka sukha, nekama sukha, paviveka sukha, upasama sukha, bodhi sukha, I think. Yeah, it's on page 557, paragraph 21. The Buddha speaks about the bliss. He's speaking about the jhanas, the deep stages of deep meditative absorption. This is called the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of enlightenment. And I say of this kind of pleasure that it should be pursued, it should be developed, should be cultivated, and should not be feared. Now, it's not that one is giving up pleasure in order to function at the level of a vegetable. just everything just dull and dreary, like gray skies every day, gray mood every day. No, but it's like going deeper and deeper inside, and it's like layers of sunshine are opening up and flowers are blooming inside, and everything is becoming, you know, brighter, more radiant, more luminous. Okay, so those are the three questions. Okay, please.
Since the existence of the five aggregates naturally give rise to the clinging, so if we die, then five aggregates dissolve.
Yeah.
What's the basis of the clinging that drive the clinging go from one life to the other life?
Let us just put it very simply, that as long as that clinging is present, that clinging will, you say, propel or create or construct a new assemblage of the five aggregates in which to continue. The clinging doesn't need a kind of vehicle to continue, but just the clinging by itself within the five aggregates. When those five aggregates pass away, it creates a new set of five aggregates. Maybe it's a little bit like within the fruit, there are the seeds. When the fruit drops down to the ground, don't try to take this simile too literally, but the seeds will create a new tree which will give rise to new fruits, and then those fruits will drop down and deposit their seeds in the ground. So that's the way it works with clinging, gives rise to the five aggregates. On the basis of the five aggregates, there's clinging. This clinging gives rise to a new set of five aggregates. Oh, Katya. Okay. Let's just pause for one moment. Two moments. Okay, better ask the question. It seems it's going to go on forever. Okay. I said, I didn't say the clinging is a new set of five aggregates.
No, I said it continues to be. As long as clinging is present, it will continue to construct a new set of five aggregates.
Right, that's right. Yeah.
And it doesn't require a vehicle
for
clinging.
Yeah.
So, but say one has an addiction to heroin.
Yeah.
And into the next lifetime,
yeah.
Would that addiction carry itself out again?
Okay.
And then until it ceases to exist?
Yeah, okay, that's a very good question. And, you know, I can't give a definite answer because I don't know, but what I would say is probably a strong addictive tendency would carry through in some form into the next existence. So that tendency would be there to get addicted to something, whether it turns out to be heroin or something else, I don't know. But eventually to get free from addiction to this or that, the person has to deal with the addictive tendency itself.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll take one more question and I want to finish the sutta.
I'm just not clear about the sense in which clinging creates a new set of aggregates. And is that in an infinite series? I mean, is it that does it actually create a new set of aggregates, or is it that it makes you select from amongst the five aggregates differently in your concept of yourself so that parts of the original five aggregates fall into unconsciousness and disuse, while others are emphasized because you identify more with them.
Oh, that could definitely happen. Yeah. But generally, say if it's going to be a human rebirth, then the clinging will construct a set of five aggregates of a human birth. But if the person in this life, life A, has a strong identification with a particular aggregate, with say somebody is very much identified with feeling, like a very emotional person, given to aesthetic experiences, then there'll be a tendency for that aggregate to be again emphasized in the new existence. So the person will tend to be more a feeling-prone person in the new life. Whereas if somebody is more like an intellectual, a thinker, then that might affect the aggregate, say, of consciousness in the next life. So that aggregate will have a stronger function. That's my supposition. Okay, let us just take the discourse through to its conclusion. Okay, so when the Buddha finished his exposition, now the Wanderer Magandhya exclaims, this is sort of like stock passage. Excellent, magnificent Master Gotama, you have taught the Dhamma in many ways, as though you were turning upright what was upside down, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, holding up a lamp in the dark for one with eyesight to see forms. Now he goes for refuge to the Buddha Dharma Sangha, and now, surprise, he says, I would receive the going forth under Master Gotama. That means he wants to become a monk disciple under Master Gotama. I would receive the full admission. He wants to become fully admitted to the Buddhist monastic order. Then the Buddha said, one who formerly belonged to another sect, because Magandhya belonged to another sect, and wants to enter my Dhamma and discipline, normally lives on probation for 4 months. As I explained this recently in relation to to one of the Vajragotha Suttas. So he will live on probation for 4 months, which means he becomes actually a novice, a samanera, for 4 months, and he lives as a novice so the other monks can observe him. And then if the monks are satisfied with him, with his behavior, his attitudes, and so on, then they can give him the full ordination, and he becomes a bhikkhu, a fully ordained monk. But then the Buddha says, because the Buddha is the founder of the teaching, he says, I recognize individual differences in this matter. Then Magandhya says, if others have to live on probation for 4 months, then I'll live on probation for 4 years. And then if the monks are satisfied, they can give me the full ordination. But the Buddha used his own discretion and gave, you know, it's like the pass to Magandhya to take ordination immediately. And so Magandhya received the going forth. He received the full admission. Then not long after his full admission or his full ordination, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, now he's called the Venerable Magandhya, realized for himself with direct knowledge, and here and now entered on and abided in the supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. He directly knew birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, and there is no more coming back to any state of conditioned existence. And so the Venerable Magandhya became one of the Arahants. And that's the end of the Magandhya Sutta. Okay, we could have some more discussion after the lunch period. And so this class, this is the end of the spring semester. And then we have like a little break now because there's the summer school takes place here next weekend. And so we'll have the next class, we'll start again the summer session, summer school, on July 15th, and Venerable Sudama was to send out the program with classes with the announcement this morning, and it will go up on the Buddhist Association website if you want to see, if you didn't get it this morning and you want to follow it. And I will give on that day, July 15th, those who want can come at 9 o'clock, then I'll just give a repetition of the basic instructions of meditation for anybody who wants basic instructions. Okay, we'll end the session with the sharing of the merits. So I think you have the formula in front of you. And the formulas for the recitation are now up on the website. Okay, so you can chant along with me. Akasa ta chabumata adeva naga mahitika punyantang anumodipa shirang rakantu sasanam. Akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodipa Chiram rakantu desanam akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu mam param etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampate siddhya etavata cham hehi Sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavagupadaya avicihe tato etantare satakayupapanna Rupiya rupicha asanya sanino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibutin. Okay, we could end with three bows to the Buddha.